Okay. Right, so the idea of doing a talk about sort of what we look for in the kernel for auditing is it'll give people an idea of what they should also be looking for in their own code and in other people's code. Because one thing that's certainly shown up in kernel auditing, like everything else, is you can take code written by the most conscientious, careful developer, and you can spend half an hour and you can find a bug in it. So, first thing is probably, why do we want to audit all this code? Well, most obvious thing is that all programmers are fallible, some more fallible than others, but it doesn't really matter where we get code from, it will have mistakes in it. Not only that, programmers are very bad at seeing their own errors. It's like people who write documents are very bad at seeing their own spelling mistakes, because particular mistakes you make are mistakes you will always make, will keep making. So a new pair of eyes really, really helps. Another thing that happens is people will post a piece of code and it works, it's reasonably correct, but somebody else will come along and you say, you know, that code could be 70 lines shorter if you just use this function in the standard part of the kernel, which the original programmer didn't know about. We also have to audit code because what constitutes good code changes over time. We invent new interfaces. So, for example, Linux has been developing support for hot plug. Linux has been developing support for non-PC hardware. So all of a sudden, you've got all this old code that doesn't work on 64-bit machines. Who cares? Doesn't work on machines which aren't a PC. Who cares? And doesn't particularly work if you hot unplug it on all this fancy high-end hardware. And most of the original developers don't care. Of course, over time, what's happened is card bus is hot plug PCI bus, basically, so everyone suddenly cares about that. In about 6 months' time, lots of people are probably going to be buying AMD 64-bit processors. And they're all going to be going, my old scanner doesn't work. My keyboard device doesn't work. My TV card doesn't work. And so we actually want to be auditing all the code and getting rid of these old interfaces. Because regardless of the attitude people have taken in the past, which may have been valid at that point, all of these generic, random, horrible pieces of PC hardware are going to turn up in 64-bit machines. And we do security auditing, but it is almost always a mistake to take kernel code and audit it for security. Simply because if you are doing a general audit of a piece of code, you are just as likely to find security holes. The only real case for doing a specific security audit is when somebody finds a bug in one piece of code, and it's perhaps a bug we haven't thought of before. And then you actually want to go through all the rest of the kernel code, particularly code copied based on that code, and say, is this bug in any other pieces of code? Recently we did this with Ethernet drivers. Somebody noticed that one or two of the drivers didn't pad small packets, and so you get a correct IP packet, and on the end of it will be something like somebody else's previous FTP password command. So it can be inconvenient when these little things happen, especially when they come out the other side of the firewall. And at that point, yes, we did sit down and we did a security audit on 80 or 90 Ethernet drivers, specifically looking for the one bug. But in the normal case, you pick up a piece of code, and the idea is to figure out, how can we break it? Most importantly, there are lots of arguments about why free software works and why open source scales. This is the key. This is the actual truth. Everybody is a great critic. So the first kind of things we look for are all the little things in maths overflows. C programs have this nice habit that if you add two large numbers together, you get a very small number. You don't get an exception, you don't get a trap, nothing like that. In addition to which, a lot of programmers don't know, if you add two signed numbers together in C, the result is undefined when you overflow. That didn't used to be a problem because everybody knew how the assembler would deal with it. But modern versions of GCC know it's undefined. And therefore, they choose to do different things to what to those the processor would do in order to optimize your code, which is very nice of them. It broke several pieces of the kernel code when they did that. So what kind of things happen here? Well, the classic one you get is you take a user input value and you multiply it by, say, the size of something, you know, like the size of some kind of disk structure or the size of an array element you're passing. And then you compare it and you say, you know, is it more than a K, more than 1024? And what actually happens is some evil person comes along and passes a great big number. And we multiply the larger number by 4, and we end up with 100. So we allocate 100 bytes of memory, and we copy 2.5 gigabytes of memory into it, and we wonder why the machine crashes. This particular one has actually turned up huge numbers of times recently, not in kernel code, but in image processing. The XPDF bug recently, some of the bugs a while ago in GDK PixBuff, the bugs in mlib are all this type, because everyone was doing X from an untrusted source, multiplied by Y from an untrusted source, multiplied by 3 or 4. Allocate that amount of memory, read a huge amount of untrusted data from the network, and ooh, that's interesting, where did that shell come from? The same thing happens with strings. We had bugs in the hot plug code, because somebody said, take a user input value for the length of the string, add 1 to it for the zero marker, and check the length. So if you pass in FFFF, FFFF for the length of your string, we allocate 0 bytes of memory. And then we copy into it. Where were we? Another thing in the C language is, of course, that the C compilers are allowed to pad things. So if you define a structure in C, the chances are, unless you are fairly careful and think very hard about the way your architecture works, that if you, for example, have a char followed by a long, you'll have 3 bytes of space. So you have a char, 3 bytes of compiler padding, and a long. Except on some machines, you'll have 7 bytes of padding. On 68K machines, you'll have 1 byte of padding. And so in the kernel, we're fairly careful to sort of fill all the fields in. The compiler has this really, really helpful feature called attribute packed. So you can say, don't pad this array. And people are doing things on the 3, particularly on x86, very conscientiously put in all these attribute packed fields. And they think, you know, this is solved, it's an old nice portable code. The only trouble is, one thing it doesn't do is ensure that the fields are on suitable alignments. So if you've got, if you use things like attribute packed, you declare yourself an array where a long or an integer starts on an odd boundary. Works beautifully on your PC, and you get all this hate mail from alpha users and M68K users, and even worse from the ARM users, because on some of the ARM processors, instead of giving you a fault saying, excuse me, this is misaligned, it just gives you the wrong data. So these people spend a week finding out what you did to them. And endianness. Every computer of relevance is little endian. We all know this. It's very simple. And it upsets a lot of people if you think that way. In truth, if people who are writing code don't have access to a big endian machine, you are never going to get it right. There is no earthly way someone with just a PC is going to get things right. But making the effort does at least mean, and thinking it does at least mean that when somebody with a big endian platform finally wants to use your driver, they actually don't have too much work to do. They sort of figure out, you know, which one or two cases have you missed, and sort out the problem. The next game, so one where hot plugging makes things lots of fun, and why in a lot of the older kernels, it was always great fun to take a USB device and a laptop and go like this. And you could play this little game and see if you could get to 100 before your computer crashed. So whenever you're looking at code, you should be able to answer, where is anything we allocate created? Where is it destroyed? And is there a point where you can say, this object cannot possibly be in use. If you can't figure that out, then probably there is something wrong with the driver. There are lots of ways of solving this problem, and there are lots of pieces of code that don't solve it. You know, I'm currently working on trying to solve this problem with the IDE drivers. And with the existing IDE code, some of these questions, even where is it created, are occasionally a bit vague and mysterious still. If you know where something is created, destroyed, and finished with, it's relatively easy to write code which won't break when somebody does this with the USB cable. And a lot of the kernel code, you will see people doing reference counting. So in other words, if there's a lot of cases where you don't know how many people have referenced, used, borrowed copies of an object. So you simply count them. The network layer does this. Anything which takes a pointer to a network device adds one to the reference count. When you free it, you reduce the count by one. Which means when you come to destroy a network device, you actually know how many people are currently using this piece of data. And the result of that is you can defer the destruction of the data until finally nobody is using it. It's a very simple way of dealing with these things. Lisp purists get deeply offended because reference counting does not solve the general case of the problem. It does solve all of the relevant cases for the real world, so that's fine. Another thing we'll try and look at, whenever you create something, is the one place it is created. This is something we've been doing a lot of work on. Alvero has done a lot of work on, especially in the file system. Because if there's two different places you create something, one of them will always forget a field. And even if they are both perfectly in sync, somebody will always update some piece of code and forget one, every time. And so you get all these strange things. Well, you're looking at this trace, and it doesn't make sense, and something is impossibly corrupted. And finally, you find out it happened because RiserFS allocated an inode object, which was then reused by something completely different like NFS. And RiserFS alone had a different creation function for an object. And they didn't fill in some field the NFS people had added. So we try and make sure that everything has common creation functions. And if you go around doing things like creating inodes yourself, or inventing your own device structures and filling them in by hand, the chances are your code won't go into the kernel. Another important one while you're looking at creation is all of the object filled in. Are the bits of your object which should start as zero and statistically do? We have plenty of code we found in the kernel which only statistically started with the right values. It turns out free memory is normally zero. The kernel has a thing called slab poisoning, which is very useful for this. And what the slab poisoning code does is, before any memory is allocated, we fill it with random irritating junk. When you free it, we overwrite it with more random irritating junk. So that if you reference data you freed, we catch you. There was a time when the kernel wouldn't boot with slab poisoning enabled when we first did this. And some people were staring at driver code wondering how on earth it had run reliably for 400 days. Yeah, and a lot of these things you find, if you actually do all the research, you discover it can't happen. Yeah. You have all of these cases where, yes, I forgot to fill in a field, but it's always used by this function before, this other function, and that happens to fill it in. There are other cases where all of these things are very obscure. Maybe 1 in 100,000 times something can go wrong. You know, we've had bugs which happen on every 65,536th object. We've had bugs where people got types wrong. Famously, the alpha floppy driver in 2.0 used to work on alternate months. Well, near enough. It's actually 20-something days, because somebody was using a 32-bit value for the timer, and time is 64-bit values. And there's just no way you will catch a lot of these kind of 1 in 100,000 bugs live on systems, at least not without really upsetting users. So being able to ask all these questions, have I filled in all of my object? Do I know where my object is freed? Do I know what I'm doing with it? And the final one, of course, in every error case particularly, am I freeing all the resources? Because if you've got a machine which is up for a year, you don't have to leak very much memory each day for it to become a real problem. So you have to be very careful all of your resources are freed. Commonly what happens there is somebody will allocate an object. It may have indicated somebody freed wrong memory. Because we trash an object to make sure that you don't reuse it. But if you do something like k-free some index of it, sometimes you'll get away with it. And the result is the poor sod who allocates that alleged memory next time gets a piece of random user space for their memory, and then the memset will loops. So it could be something like that. It's hard to tell. Until we can run the entire kernel under tools like Valgrind, which hopefully will happen for user mode Linux soon, it's actually fairly tricky sometimes to find all of these. Yeah. It's a very good idea to memset your objects. Unless it's a very large object and, we have cases where we've got like 4 kilobyte objects, and you don't really want to memset those, just you want to think about them. We have specific types for specific sizes. So we've got things like U8, U16, U32. The size of a short is a little suspect sometimes. The size of a long is an extremely variable quantity. It's 32 or 64 bits on current platforms. Pointers are also 32 or 64 bits. So using these write types can save things. We also always use unsigned longs to store things like PCI bus addresses, IO port addresses, and that's a conscious decision to make sure that we cover the worst case. Currently, if you use a 32-bit value, everything works except for the spark. So the new ID code worked beautifully, and then I got some really, really, really annoyed mail from one particular person. So, you should see unsigned long everywhere. It's another thing that is easy to check when you're reading somebody's code. And then we have people who think, well, it's a PC, I remember DOS, it's that address there, so poke. Which also kind of works on PC hardware. You can write directly to PCI addresses. It also gets a lot of people without PC hardware very upset, because this particular kind of mapping isn't the way a lot of systems work. Some people have cache TLB bypasses. Some people have very, very strange hardware. And there are people whose IO resources for PCI bus are truly, truly demented. I mean, really demented. The point where when you don't actually have a way of doing an IO address, instead you do several writes to a PCI bus controller to ask it to fake an IO access on the bus. So it's important people use things like readb, writeb, and don't use memcpy on PCI bus addresses. Amongst other things, we do caching and cache clever tricks on this. So we read data out of order, we write data out of order. We do prefetch instructions, which do very, very bad things on uncached space with some processors. So if you use memset in PCI space by mistake, well, amongst other things, early Athlon people won't be able to use your software. DMA is lots of fun. He said, the best way I know to shoot yourself in both feet simultaneously while the debugger has the CPU stopped. So we have lots of old code, especially going up to 2.4, which says, what's the bus address of this virtual address on my machine? I'm going to use DMA and just dump stuff in it. Doesn't work on non-PC hardware, and doesn't work on things like Athlon 64. So in 2.5, all programs that do this, software does this, you have to go and fiddle with, fix, recompile. And that's one of the things that led to a lot of the SCSI code being audited. Because people looked at it and said, so I need to do DMA for, how the hell does this driver work? there are certain things you should not be using as DMA targets, even on a PC. Memory allocated with vmalloc is scattered around your address map at random. So it only looks linear to the processor, and if you copy sort of 8K into it, well, you're copying 4K into the memory you intended, and 4K to some random poor victim in the next page. We have proper DMA APIs now, so you should also not be using Hipages. And there are people who used to DMA onto the stack. Even the SCSI layer used to do DMA onto the stack. This has two very bad consequences. One of which is it doesn't work on things like PowerPC 64 because the stack is virtually allocated. So every so often, you end up DMAing partly onto the stack and partly somewhere random and interesting. The other one is we've had bugs where somebody accidentally returns from a function doing DMA onto the stack without stopping the DMA. And if you want to try and debug code where somebody else randomly writes values into the middle of your return stack, you stop it, you look at it in the debugger, it's right. You look at it in the debugger again, it's wrong. One famous case of this was chasing a bug in one of the TV card drivers. And the only reason somebody finally figured it out was because their machine crashed while they had a serial debugger on it. And they were looking at the area of memory, and they said this is a big chunk of memory had mysteriously gone strange. They copy this piece of memory out. It was looking, there was a kind of regular pattern to it. He turned it into an image, and he found a CNN news frame in his kernel. and we have the PCI bus, and we now support hot plug. Which means that it's not just the poor USB people where you're going like this with your connectors. You can do this to all the PCI cards, especially if you've got some nice high-end IBM hardware. So you can have lots and lots of fun breaking all the drivers. Some of the code, like the SCSI layer, we haven't really addressed hot plug yet because it's too hard for the moment. IDE hot plug is a, tactfully called a work in progress. We're hopeful that not too many people will go insane before the project is complete. PCI has some interesting properties very few people know about. It's a great way of really, really upsetting people because interrupts and PCI and the PCI bus are asynchronous. So you can actually talk to the PCI bus, write to a device and say, please send me no more interrupts. You can even then read from the device to check the write is completed, which you should do. And it says, yes, I've turned off interrupts. And about a fraction of a millisecond later, you get an interrupt. Because the interrupts on some of the boards go as a completely separate, fairly slow bus. And so suddenly, you turn off the interrupt, as the interrupt turned off, free all the resources, and you get an interrupt, and bad things happen. So you have to be very careful that you've actually done free IRQ and got rid of your interrupt handler before you free the resources. PCI is message-based. It doesn't look like a message-based bus because the hardware engineers did very nice things to keep the software people happy. The only trouble is if you don't think it's a message-passing bus, other very strange things happen. One of which is, if you write to a PCI bus device, the hardware is allowed to do optimizations. Some of those include saying, okay, you want to write to this PCI bus device. Yeah, okay, I know you want to write to it. I'll figure it out later. So you can write, and this is what happened with the TV card, write to the PCI bus device, please stop. Free the memory. And unfortunately, but you freed the memory, but the PCI control was thinking, I should get around to sending this message at some point. And the TV card was happily going, here you are, here's CNN, fill the kernel with it. So there is a rule with PCI, to make sure a PCI write has actually definitely happened, you have to do a read from the same device. So you actually, so if you, for things like a reset, you write to the device, you read from it, you wait whatever your time delay is, you write to it again. Otherwise, you may not be getting the delays you think. And PCI domain memory ordering is a separate and fascinating topic, particularly on non-PC systems. If you use the DMA API we have now, it's all taken care of for you, as is cache handling. If you don't do that, then you need the architecture manuals for every CPU Linux runs on. So I would strongly recommend you use the official API. Resources are finite. This is something people are very good at forgetting. We have relatively small amounts of memory in the kernel. It's not swappable. And it's a very bad idea if you find a driver which says, take some user-provided number, allocate that much memory. Though we found a few of them. Other classic one is drivers which will queue an infinite number of buffers. Particularly bad in things like networking, because what actually happens is you get very, very large amounts of input data. So you start queuing. Now, the more data you queue, the more you have to swap, the slower you get, the more data you have to queue. And several seconds later, you run out of memory. In interrupt handling, again, interrupt handling's got to be fast. You don't want to get stuck just handling interrupts. With old network cards, you can actually do this to Linux and to just about any other operating system. If you take a Windows PC or a Linux PC with an older network card, and then you take a nice fancy Cisco packet generator and you send it 100,000 packets a second, it stops. Because the poor machine is going, oh, look, a pack, oh, look, a pack, oh, look. And in more serious environments, you have to be careful anyway, because you don't want to get stuck doing infinite amounts of work. If your network card keeps saying another packet, another packet, another packet, it's actually a good idea in the drive to have a point where you've really been round your interrupt handler in a tight loop a few times too many, and just say, another packet, fine. I no longer wish to receive packets. And just set a timer and catch up later. In 2.5, the NAPI interface solves it for drivers that use that. What basically we do there is under high load, we start switching to things like timers and polling. We just turn the interrupt off and say, this interrupt is just too noisy. You know, every so often we'll come around, we'll service this network card, and as a result of that, you get real worked up. Because the other thing, if you actually plot graphs of useful work done against interrupt rate and packet rates, there's a certain point where you actually dropping packets is the right thing to do. Because if you don't drop packets, the amount of useful work you do goes down. So you're spending most of your time receiving packets and throwing them away because user space can't deal with them in time. And we have a stack. We have a relatively small stack. The reason for this is we have to have a stack, kernel stack, for each process. So if you've got 1,000 processes, we allocate 1,000 8K stacks. 8 megabytes of your machine is stacks, which are unswappable. And so we don't want to let these be large. So when we're looking through driver code, we're looking for suspicious things like char x16384. Or arrays of 1,000 structures, not wishing to name any particular driver that did that. It may only be a 4K stack, because some of the platforms like x86-64 have separate stacks for each interrupt, and then stacks for user processes. This lets you have smaller stacks, and as a result, your total stack memory usage of stacks goes down. It also lets you optimize some of the code paths fairly well. Look at finite resources, my machine's gone to sleep. Oh yeah. Common thing we look for in the code is with spin locks. If you take a lock and you take a lock again, in Linux, you deadlock. Quite a few other operating systems have probably auto counting or recursive spin locks, where you can take the same lock three times and unlock it three times and all works. Linux spin locks are designed to be very simple, very fast. The basic Linux spin lock, if you take it and you take it again, your machine stops. Unless you have a uniprocessor machine, because the uniprocessor kernel, you actually take out all the spin locks when you compile. So if you are writing device drivers, build yourself an SMP kernel. Even if you don't have a multiprocessor machine, try it on an SMP kernel. With 2.5, also try it with preempt enabled, because that will find a lot of the multiprocessor type errors that you may otherwise not find. And I've had several submissions, including one or two from sort of vendors who are created on the NASDAQ and other places like this, where if you compile their driver into an SMP kernel, it hung the machine on boot, including one which had passed their test lab QA. So we're very careful to sort of test all this stuff. 2.5 has some very nice things. So if you sleep holding a lock, you get a big, nice warning message, which is, some ways it's a lot better than looking for these kind of things by hand, because by hand you will sometimes miss them. The problem with 2.4 is that you are not allowed to sleep holding a spin lock. But almost every time it works. Almost every time. So it's one of these kind of things you can only find by looking through the code and checking it. In 2.5, you get a dirty great warning that says your code sucks, or somebody else's code sucks, preferably. Copying data to and from user space sleeps. That's one a lot of people don't realize in drivers, because if you take a lock and you copy data to user space and that memory is on disk, well, we're actually going to go and sort of get this data off disk and do other real work. And needless to say, for that kind of thing, we sleep. And yes, and this is another thing commonly done by large vendors rather than individuals. I got a warning about sleeping in an sleeping with locks held. So I've added a busy loop for half a second. That'll fix it. Or worse. But I think the record was one Arjan van de Ven found where a driver could sleep for 19 and a half minutes in theory. It was a fiber channel drive of all things. So you know, your highly available critical database server could get to sleep for almost 20 minutes by mistake. So the other thing I do is these, there is a right way to do sleeping, and busy loops in general is not the right answer, even if it's easier to program. And there's one horrible catch which gets lots of people writing drivers for the first time, lots of people writing drivers for the 10th or 30th time, which is you can't disable an interrupt while you are holding a lock which is taken by that interrupt handler. Simply because what actually happens is on one processor, occasionally, the interrupt handler starts, disable IRQ starts on the other CPU, the disable IRQ path owns the lock. So the interrupt handler is sitting there going, I'm waiting for the lock, I'm in the interrupt handler, I can't do anything, I'm waiting for the lock. The disable IRQ code goes, I'm waiting for the interrupt to finish. It's one we found in quite a bit of code. It's just not obvious, not well documented. So we check for it very carefully. We care a great deal about the order you finish things. So we have lots of drivers which used to do things like free all the memory, turn off the interrupt handler, unload, leave the timer running. All sorts of other terrible combinations that led to disasters. When you're looking at driver code or writing a driver, you have to think about what are the worst possible cases. People assume, oh, my driver is unloading, and they think nothing else is happening. But while a piece of code is unloading or a driver is closing, somebody else might be opening it. So you have to make sure, for example, that you stop somebody else opening your device while it's being unloaded. You have to make sure that you've finished any DMA before you free the memory. You have to make sure that everybody's finished using the memory before you free it. And you care about little details like making sure that timer functions have actually been stopped. It's another one where most of the time it works. Because what happens is you unload the module, the timer function is called, the pages of memory haven't been reused. They kind of contain the right code and data still. So the timer handler runs and it sort of turns itself off. Except when your machine is very busy or you're particularly unlucky, and then it crashes. So you have to be very careful with all these sort of ordering things. If you've got threads created by a driver, you have an interesting problem if it's a loadable module, because you are executing code in the module you're going to unload, and you have to wait for the thread. Now, if you just wait for a piece of code, wait until this thread says it's finished, you don't know if on another processor the thread has set the flag saying, I finished, but hasn't finished executing for the final few instructions. So we have a function in the kernel called complete and exit, which is a function a thread can call which will get out of the module code. It will then signal the rest of the code saying, OK, I've done, and then it will exit. So it will never come back into the module, but at the same time, it will have left the module before it tells you it's finished. Ah, yes, documentation. Wonderful stuff. If you're interested in kernel documentation, it's great. There's not a great deal already, so the barrier to entry is very low. But seriously, if you are looking at a piece of code and there's something you don't understand, and you have to figure it out, please document it, because somebody else is otherwise going to have to go through the same pain you did a year later. Now, you may be some evil sadist who thinks if I had to work it out, they can. But it's more constructive if they can be working on other things. We do have a standard system for documentation of kernel functions now. It's a thing called kerneldoc, which we stole from gnomedoc, which was stolen from gtkdoc, which was stolen from javadoc. It kind of changed syntax along the way a little bit, but the theory is roughly the same. So we have a way of documenting functions and extracting all that documentation into man pages, into PDFs, mixing it up with sort of other handwritten documentation. We've got things like mouse driver documents, which include the relevant API functions, and actually pull those out of the kernel. The idea for that being that if the comment is directly above the function, the person who changes the function will hopefully remember to change the comment. It does seem to work most of the time. And it's also very obvious that you get a patch from somebody, and there's like they change the function, number of arguments, and the context at the top of the patch has two arguments in the comment. And if you find and you do audits, make it clear in the comments, when you sort of commented, you checked it through, which release you did. Because we've been doing some of the audits, and it's like one piece of code, it's a really helpful comment, audited by so-and-so. I think, when? So I went back through all the releases. Turned out somebody audited it in 1.3 point something or other. So it was no longer a useful audit, but there was no good way of telling that. I say, if there's existing documentation in the functions, reformat them into things like kernel doc so that they're all in the standard format. If you discover a new error, go looking elsewhere for it, particularly in similar drivers. Every so often somebody says, you know, I've been looking at the serial driver and I wondered what happened if. And then somebody fixes it and you look at it and you say, lots of other serial drivers are kind of based on each other. Yeah, they're all kind of versions of each other, often in loops where they're sort of continuously stealing bits from other serial drivers. And so sometimes you look and go, yeah, that driver's buggy. That driver's buggy. This is interesting. And you discover that every single serial driver in the kernel has the same bug. Sometimes what that actually tells you is it's about time that this piece of code was taken out of each serial driver and put in sort of the common serial code, some of which is happening in 2.5. Or sometimes each driver is genuinely a little different, but they've copied the same mistake. And then very occasionally somebody comes along and goes, and asks them all terribly horrible, yeah, that's a bug really. What happens if, and you look at it, and you look at the kernel and the user space and everything else. And it's one of these that happened, for example, when people started asking, what about signed numeric overflows being undefined? And it started off in one or two user space applications and the kernel, and people started looking through their web servers, their cryptographic libraries, SSH, you know, various bits of SSH starting using unsigned variables. And they look through it and say, well, it happens to be safe at the moment. So sometimes people will actually say, you actually start with sort of what happens if, and it kind of ripples through huge amounts of code, just because nobody had ever thought of that particular question before. I said, if you report these kind of things, it does help. Common thing we get when people have decided to clean up a driver is this huge patch. And it basically starts, the patch says, delete the entirety of the old one, here's the new one. Because the old one wasn't in the proper format, like a SCSI driver with the wrong tab indenting. So somebody went, okay, well, indent it. I'll change all of this code around, shuffle all the comments, send it to Linus and expect him to understand the changes. It's very, very important that we get changes in a way we can review. People can review them. So what normally happens if you've got a piece of code you're going to edit and you look at it, and it's not in proper kernel format, it's horrible. Indent it, do nothing else, and send the maintainer or Linus or the mailing list the first patch, which just says, I've re-indented this code with indent, I've been through it by hand, tidied up any of the horrible things indent sometimes does. There are no code changes. And we can merge that into the kernel. And if somebody comes along and says, you know, 2.5.61 broke my SCSI driver, and all we did was indent it, we know something weird has happened. But it means that when we do get real breakage, when we sort of add the next patches, first of all, we can read the next patches because they make sense. Yeah, instead of like delete two or three lines, add some feature. But it also means we can separate out which specific feature broke the driver, which is very, very important for debugging. Because a lot of the weirder bugs, when it comes to debugging them, the most efficient thing you can do is add this change, it's broken. take this change out, it works. Okay, so how is this particular tiny piece of code breaking things? If somebody sends you a patch which simply says, I've reformatted the entire driver and rewritten half of it, there is no earthly way you can do that kind of debugging on it. Sort of, it's a take it or leave it. If the new one doesn't work, it's back to the old one. So we don't generally take those kind of patches. If people can break changes down, I mean, it's very easy, you get carried away, tidy up a piece of code, and you think, oh, I'll just fix this as well. Use something like CVS or just keep backups. And every stage along the way, but take another copy, take another copy. That way you can feed changes one at a time. So you can sort of say, this is the first version I tested where I fixed the memory allocation. And then you can say, after I fixed the memory allocation, I did this. And you give this set of patches, one after another. And you can apply some of them, all of them. And ultimately, if someone finds a mistake in one of them, it's quite common, so you sort of said this is a sort of set of six patches to a driver, someone says, you know, patch number three is wrong. You can still apply the other five quite often, rather than having all six of them thrown away and then spending a week trying to get Linus to actually notice you've sent them again. Okay, that's sort of the end of the talk part of it. It should put us with about the right time for questions. So we start with on-topic questions first, is always a good thing. The back on the left. Most of them are. There's people at Stanford who are working on a DoD-funded project where they're actually doing modifying GCC to do sort of checks on kernel things. You know, like if a function enters with a spin lock held, does it always exit with a spin lock held? Doing tainting, very much like the Perl tainting idea. So if a variable, if data came from user space, it's unsafe. Is unsafe data sent fed to any interesting functions? So we get regular reports from them saying, you know, this array is 8 items long and you copy 9 bytes into it, sort of thing. There is work going on to try and get the user mode Linux able to run under Valgrind, and then to teach Valgrind all of the rules about kernel memory allocation and locks. And in theory then, Valgrind can give you very, very accurate data about any point you touch memory you've not initialized. That's a lot of work, but I have a feeling once somebody finally gets this thing working properly, we are going to get a lot of bug reports. And it, yes, matches another, yes. Not one I'm particularly familiar with.
It's not very good yet.
Well, okay. So there are these kind of things going on. And in the kernel, we've got various things we put in, particularly designed to be runtime checkers. So that if a particular event occurs in the kernel, which is normally non-fatal, it helps immensely if we can trap it and print a warning. So the user's still running that machine. The user machine is still happy. But the user's sort of mailing people saying, yeah, last Wednesday my kernel told me that I did a sleep with a spin lock held in such and such driver. I don't know what on earth it's talking about, but I figured you might be interested in it. Is it to the front left?
I'm just curious. I always hear stories about people running Crashly, a program that generates random
yep.
data and jumps into it.
Yep.
Anybody ever tried that with Linux kernel?
We do it all the time. In fact, Crashly is part of the standard test set Red Hat run. We run a load of load testers, things like Cerberus. CrashMe is part of that. POSIX test suites for coverage. So CrashMe has been running all the time. CrashMe nowadays tends to find CPU bugs rather than kernel bugs on i386 Linux. It's still finding kernel bugs occasionally, particularly on architectures where some of the handling is much more complex, like MEPS in particular. There's some at the very back. Initiative of, sorry? It's an ongoing thing that various people have been doing. It's sort of become a bit more formal in some ways over time. We now have a thing called the kernel janitors, who basically go around looking at all of the code and cleaning things up. And where somebody fixes a bug, checking all of the other code. There are often people who are new to Linux, because of course, going through a load of code, looking to see if there's a bug, making a change you understand, it's a very good way of learning the code. We also have a trivial patch maintainer, which has been a particularly useful thing. He's just exited out the back door. There goes Rusty. And the trivial patch maintainer means that it's much easier to get very small patches into the kernel. And a lot of these debugging fixes can be very, very small. So that's helped as well. But there's no one's actually sat down and said, we are going to audit Linux in that way. Yes. Lots of programmers hate writing documentation. I love it when someone like documents how my driver works. It's really good, especially sometimes when they document it and it says, I don't know what this bit does. And I look at it and think, yeah, that's a good question. I don't know why it does that either. Which does sometimes happen. So yeah, do send doc patches. We have people who just send spelling fixes. Now, somebody once sent me a patch with some other lines of 137 fixes for misspellings of, I think it was of necessary, and this sort of thing. And what's scariest about the spelling patches, and they never come from people who are that first language. It's always foreign language people who correct their spelling. Yep. Well, I haven't been to America. I mean, Red Hat is in North Carolina, so it's no great cultural loss anyway. In terms of the DMCA, things like the Lexmark case and some of the things before it are starting to make the Americans more aware that they actually need to go and revisit the law. I mean, some of the things the DMCA tries to do are quite sensible. A lot of these things where people are doing mass theft of movies and stuff is a big issue. You know, and Napster, however you look at it, has been an interesting way of distributing data and a fascinating technology. Was being primarily used for dubious things. Probably the Napster people should never have been sued for it. And that's kind of another thing where the US law is wrong. But at the same time, as wanting to pass a law saying, you know, mass piracy is a crime. You know, regardless of how you think about copyright law, that's how the law currently works. You don't want to pass a law which basically says, we're allowed to be your monopoly toner provider. And we're allowed to make sure that blind people can't read our books, and these kind of things. There's a balance they have to figure out, which is always a very complex issue. And it's an issue which depends, I think, on the country and the kind of social views of those countries. But I get the impression, you know, another year or two, they're going to figure out that, like, chasing after people who say, excuse me, your security sucks, is a bad idea. Especially since they have all these things saying, help the US government, tell us about our security. And by the way, it's illegal if you let us know.
As a follow-up to that, given the European Union is increasingly
passing similar things to Europe. No. The European one we have to fight from the inside. We're actually getting somewhere on that. Only two countries in the entire EU ratified the copyright directive as is. Even before they ratified it, there are a set of meetings scheduled to go and look over things like the competition issues, disabled rights issues, and try and figure out all the bits the Americans got wrong. Because the Europeans now have this great thing, they have this sort of lovely set of examples of how not to do it and what to fix. So they're already looking at things like, and HP are in a certain amount of trouble over printer cartridges that own and stopping other people doing HP printer cartridges. That originally came out from kind of recycling issues. And now the European Union people are looking at that, looking at the Lexmark thing, are looking at the phones, where some of the phones use cryptographic sequences to make sure you can't use third-party batteries. And I think, you know, maybe there's a general issue here. Maybe we need to make sure that all of this kind of digital rights management, we make it illegal to use it for monopolistic purposes. And in most of the Europe, it's already the case, it's illegal to use a patent for monopolistic purposes. So, yeah, you can license a patent. You can actually be in a situation where you have no choice, pretty much, but to license a patent to a competitor and get a fair price, you know, for what you're doing, but you're not allowed to use it to completely block them out, which is a very common US tactic. So, yeah, all these things are sort of trundling on, and we try and kick them in the right place bit by bit.
Yes. And the bell doesn't find that, although it's running 5 at the moment.
Yeah, one of the things you have to, I mean, Valgrind can only find things in the pieces of data it can see.
Yeah.
One thing you have to understand though, in theory, there's nothing preventing you teaching Valgrind about kernel user divides. Again, it's not kind of a sort of an easy project, but if you have the entire operating system running under the virtualized Valgrind environment, it in theory has enough information to actually spot this kind of stuff. And even to do things like say, excuse me, you just copied data that belongs to somebody else into this process. Did you mean to? And sort of so spotting things like data leaks. Oh, for time.
Could you please make down costs?
Oh, that kind of for time.